People think I ate my Rice Krispies this morning because of all the snap, crackle, and popping going on there. Got a question for you. If somebody were to come to you and to say, what is the best reason for becoming a Christian? What would you say? Would you say, well, you know, when I was a little kid, the reason was, well, I don't want to go to hell, and heaven's a good alternative, so I'll become a Christian. You know, that was kind of my little kid answer. Maybe you would say something about, you know, the historical evidence for Christianity and the reliability of Scripture. I mean, you could talk about some of those issues. Maybe you would talk about a personal experience that you had where you felt the presence of God or the peace of God. Well, this morning, I want to share with you what I think is the absolute best reason I know for giving your life to Jesus and following Him with everything you've got. We're coming up on Easter, and every year the church celebrates what's called the Triduum. It's a new Latin word I just learned this week. It's called 3 days. I mean, Triduum just means 3 days because there were 3 days that changed the world, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And over the next 3 weeks, we're going to take a look at each of those days. We're going to look at Friday today and go into Saturday next week, and then on Easter, we'll look at Resurrection Sunday. Now, a lot of people are not real clear about exactly what happened on those 3 days. So beginning today, we're going to look at those in depth. And I'm going to be following a general outline from a sermon series John Ortberg preached several years ago. And I thought this would be really helpful for us as we kind of dig into this and look at some of the history behind this. So today we're devoting to Friday, and there's a lot of historical biblical material to wade through. But as we do this, you are going to come to know and love and admire and have a fresh sense of wonder for Jesus. And we are going to be able to see what I think is the very best reason for following Jesus with everything you have. And we're actually going to begin at the end of the day on Friday and kind of work our way backwards. So just picture this. It's Friday, late afternoon. Just outside the gates of Jerusalem, there are three crosses. There's bodies hanging on the outside two crosses, but the one in the middle has already been emptied. And on this cross hangs a sign that says, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. And the question is, how did we get to this point? Why did Jesus die? How did this man who taught about things like he blessed little children and he taught about loving one another and he was known as a friend of sinners, how did he end up being executed as an enemy of the state? Well, it turns out that Friday is a day of mixed motives and odd alliances and secret meetings and explosive emotions and politicians doing cynical PR ploys. It will turn out there will be many powerful forces at work, but it's not clear that the people who thought they were in charge on this Friday really were in charge. Everybody on Friday had an agenda. And as we walk through these events, we're going to look at each of these groups, these major players, and ask, what did they want? Which agenda prevailed? Whose will prevailed? Why did Jesus die? The first major player you need to know about behind the scenes is Rome. Rome would say the reason Jesus died was because he was a threat to Rome. And any threat to Rome has to die. Why was he a threat? Well, he was called the Christ. And some people think Christ was his last name, like Joseph Christ and Mary Christ had a baby, and it was Jesus Christ. That's not it at all. Christ actually comes from a Greek word, kraio, which means to anoint. He is the anointed one. He is the Messiah. And this notion of a Messiah is very important if you're going to understand Jesus. See, there were a lot of people who claimed to be a Messiah. They were going to lead a political movement. Imagine for a moment that the Middle East is this place where religious passion and politics get mixed up in dangerous ways. I mean, hard to imagine, but that's the way it was in Jesus' day. And part of that's because of another force. It's the crowds in Jerusalem. The people are waiting for a political leader, a Messiah, who will lead them in a revolt against Rome. They want somebody who was going to overthrow Rome and lead Israel into freedom. And there were a bunch of wannabe messiahs back in the first century, in Jesus' day. But there were different thoughts about exactly what the Messiah would be, but they all agreed that the Messiah was going to be a very powerful figure. He was going to lead Israel to freedom, and he was going to overthrow Rome. That's what the Messiah was. And we read about a few of them in the New Testament, in Acts chapter 5. It says, some time ago, Theudas appeared, claiming to be somebody, and about 400 men rallied to him, and he was killed. And we're told about Theudas from an outside historian named Josephus. Josephus says Theudas was actually called a Messiah. He got a bunch of people to gather to his side. He claimed to be able to part the Jordan River and to he could make the walls of Jerusalem fall down, kind of like a modern-day Joshua. and he led a revolt against Rome. He ended up being captured by the Romans and decapitated in Jerusalem in front of the crowds, because you don't mess with Rome. Another would-be Messiah was named Judas the Galilean, and we also read about him in Acts 5. It says, after Theudas, Judas the Galilean appeared in the days of the census and led a band of people in revolt. He too was killed by Rome. Now, Judas the Galilean, we're told by Josephus, led a tax revolt. He took up arms, he got a bunch of followers to follow him, and they all got captured by Rome. And they crucified, Rome crucified about 2,000 of them. And they put the crosses all up and down the Galilean countryside because they wanted to send a message. If anybody else gets a bright idea about not paying taxes to Caesar, we got more crosses for you. By the way, that happened when Jesus was a boy. Judas the Galilean was from Galilee, the region of Galilee. Jesus was from Nazareth in Galilee. As a boy, Jesus would have seen these crosses where Rome killed people who followed any man who claimed to be a Messiah. Now, this leads to a really big question, because being a Messiah is a dangerous occupation. So how do you know if you actually are the Messiah? Well, it's kind of like the story of King Arthur and the sword and the stone. You know, whoever gets the sword out of the stone gets to be king. Arthur was the only one who could take the sword from the stone, so he got to be king. Well, how do you know if you're the Messiah? Messiah would be the guy who could beat Rome. But you don't know until you try. Here's the hard part. If you try and you don't do it, then you get crucified. So if you get crucified, then you're not the Messiah. That's how you know. And this happened time and time again. We know of at least 18 separate wannabe messiahs in Jesus' day, and they all get crucified. They get these little bands of followers, and the followers would often loot the Roman arsenals or the Roman palaces in the area. Rome regarded them as thieves. They thought they were kind of like first century Robin Hoods. You know, it's like, well, it's not Rome's property in the first place. They don't have any right to it. We ought to have it. And the Greek word for some of these characters was lestis. The people who would loot the Romans were lestis. Some of you remember a man on the cross who's known as a thief. It was like, why would they crucify a thief? Well, he wasn't like a shoplifter, like we would think of a thief. He was one of these lestis. He was part of one of these anti-Roman movements. Jesus is crucified, and yet, he is not the kind of military leader, Messiah, king. In fact, he deliberately, persistently rejects that role. Some of you guys remember back in John 11, we looked at the time when Jesus fed 5,000 people and the crowds were so excited. They're like, oh, this guy could be the Messiah. And they wanted to come and make him king by force. And Jesus is like, nope, no way. He withdraws into the hills by himself, and all the crowds are extremely frustrated. Unlike any of these other wannabe messiahs, Jesus refused to lift a finger against Rome. So why does he end up on a cross? Well, to understand this, we've got to back up further in the day, to an earlier scene on Friday when the chief priests bring Jesus before a man named Pilate, Pontius Pilate. Now, Pilate rules over Judea, including Jerusalem, on behalf of Caesar. He is called a procurator, and Pilate's job is a major headache. Nobody in his line of work wanted to be in the Middle East, because this is what the kind of stuff he has to juggle. He's got the chief priests, who are basically collaborators with Rome. They don't like Rome, but they decide to collaborate and kind of work from the inside. You've got the Pharisees, who are all about purity. If everybody just follows Torah and follows the law better, then God will, you know, free us from Egyptian oversight, or from the Roman oversight, and so on. It's all about purity for them. Then you got a group of guys called the Zealots. And the Zealots believed in might makes right, you know, force. So let's take up arms, let's fight, let's get rid of Rome that way. Use force to take down Roman rules. All these groups agree that Rome is evil, Rome has to be destroyed. So they sometimes form these alliances, and they would fight against each other on which way to do it, but they were kind of all against Rome. They're fighting each other, they're fighting Rome. Pilate's job is to keep a lid on this whole mess. I mean, this place is a political hotbed. And Pilate was as ruthless as anybody about this kind of stuff. In fact, we read, people came up to Jesus one time. In Luke 13, it says there were some present at that time who told Jesus about the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mixed with their sacrifices. I mean, think about this. Jesus is from Galilee. And some people from Galilee went down to the temple to worship. Pilate decides that they're a threat, and he has them executed on the spot, and their blood mingles with their sacrifices. That's Pilate. Another time, Pilate wants to build this aqueduct, so he steals money from the temple treasury. Takes it from the temple to build this aqueduct. The Israelites, the Jews, are furious, and so a bunch of them protest. Pilate has them all executed, all the protesters. Eventually, Pilate slaughters so many people up near Samaria, it gets so out of hand, there's so much unrest, that word gets back to Caesar. Caesar actually fires Pilate, recalls him to Rome. And that's the last we hear about him from history. An ancient writer named Philo said Pilate's rule was marked by bribery, insults, robberies, supreme cruelty, executions without a trial, and a furious, vindictive temper. Can you imagine a politician with a temper problem? This is the man in whose hands Jesus' life now rests. So the chief priests bring Jesus to Pilate, and this is the charge they make. They say, "We found this man subverting our nation. He opposes payment of taxes to Caesar, and he claims to be a Messiah, a king." Now, the chief priests don't give a rip about taxes to Caesar. They don't want to pay taxes to Caesar. But they're just trying to put political pressure on Pilate to make Pilate do what they want him to do. So they're just saying, well, you know, this Jesus is a problem for Rome. Caesar wouldn't like him. You, Pilate, better do something. Pilate, for his part, resists the chief priests. Not because he has any sympathy for Jesus, but because he always resists the chief priests. Because if they get their way, they get more power, he gets less power. It's all this power play. He doesn't want them getting stronger. He wants them getting weaker. He's looking for any reason to defy them. It's all about politics and power, and money gets thrown into this whole thing. And Pilate finds out Jesus is from Galilee, and he's like, hey, you know, Herod is really the guy that's in charge of Galilee. He has jurisdiction up there. So he sends Jesus to Herod. Herod's like, man, I'm not touching this thing with a 10-foot pole. Sends him back to Pilate. So at that point, Pilate turns to the crowds, and some of you know this story. Pilate says, well, it's feast time, it's Passover, and you know, we always release somebody at Passover. So I'll give you a choice. Should we release Jesus, who's basically harmless, or should we release Barabbas, this murderer? Anybody remember? Who does the crowd say let go of? Barabbas, yeah. Give us Barabbas. And now you start to understand why. Barabbas is a murderer, but the crowds are like, well, at least Barabbas is willing to murder Romans. Jesus won't go after the Romans. So if you're going to release somebody, let Barabbas go. Finally, Pilate washes his hands. And it's not that Pilate has a sensitive conscience or that he's worried about Jesus or thinks Jesus doesn't deserve to die. His agenda is to maintain the upper hand over the chief priests and over the temple. But the chief priests have a trump card. This is what they say to Pilate. They say, it says, from then on, Pilate tried to set Jesus free, but the Jewish leaders kept shouting, if you let this man go, you are no friend to Caesar. Anyone who claims to be king opposes Caesar. And then they say these horrible, tragic words for chief priests to say. They say, we have no king but Caesar. Pilate could not risk having Caesar think he was soft on anti-Rome terrorists. So he turns to Jesus and he asks him, are you the king of the Jews? This is a very dramatic moment. Because Jesus can go free if he wants to, if he'll just say the right thing. And it's so ironic because earlier in his ministry, people were wondering about this. And all Jesus had to do one time was to say, yep, I'm the guy, I'm the Messiah. And all of Israel, or a good chunk of it, would have risen up and fought and died for Jesus. But he wouldn't say, yeah, that's me. That's what's going on Palm Sunday. In Jerusalem, they were celebrating Passover, and Passover is very explosive in Jerusalem. Jerusalem is an occupied city, occupied by Rome. And at Passover, they're remembering when Moses led them to overthrow their oppressors. Then it was Egypt and Pharaoh. Now it's Rome, and the bad guy is Caesar. Then a young leader, Jesus, comes riding into Jerusalem, and they're going to celebrate Passover. And that's why everybody says, Hosanna to the Son of David. Who was David? He was a warrior king. But Jesus won't fight. He keeps not claiming this title. That's precisely why the crowds in Jerusalem turned so fast from Palm Sunday to Good Friday. On Palm Sunday, they thought, here's a revolution, but Jesus wouldn't revolt. He would not lift a sword. But now, before Pilate, Jesus finally gives a definitive answer to this question. When there's no chance of him being misinterpreted as a political military figure, Jesus says, yes, Pilate, yes, it's me. It's as you say, I am the one that they're waiting for. I am their king. And Jesus knows what's going to happen to him. When Jesus says this, he pronounces his own death sentence. Pilate doesn't want this to happen, but he pronounces a sentence on Jesus. So who's really making this happen? Well, to understand this, we've got to back up further in the day. Remember, the chief priests want Jesus dead because he's getting too popular. And about a week or so before this, Jesus had raised Lazarus from the dead. And everybody's talking about Jesus. Everybody's talking about this sign of Lazarus. And so the Pharisees and the chief priests get this meeting together. And we saw this in John 11. One of them stands up and says, hey, here's this man, Jesus, performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and then the Romans will come and take away both our temple and our nation. And that's exactly what happened in AD 70. There was one revolt too many, one wannabe Messiah too many, and the Romans came in and they destroyed the temple. That's why the temple's not there today. And they virtually obliterated the nation of Israel. So the chief priests knew that if unrest got too strong, Rome would swoop in and destroy Jerusalem. And that's exactly what happened eventually. Now, they also knew Jesus was not a military threat because they understood Jesus' teaching. Jesus was a threat of another kind. This Jesus was claiming that the kingdom of God that everybody had been waiting for was somehow now present on earth. That the love of God, the power of God, the grace of God, the salvation of God were now present. Only it wasn't in the temple, wasn't in the sacrifices, it wasn't in some legalistic obedience to the law that separated Jews and Gentiles. It wasn't through any of that. It was through Jesus, through this one man, through what he said and how he lived his life and how he loved. And he's telling everybody that God's presence and God's blessing and God's forgiveness and God's guidance were now available to the world through him. Not only had nobody ever said this before, nobody had even thought this before, and he proved it by the way he lived his life and the signs he was manifesting. So the Pharisees, the religious leaders, they couldn't let this stand. So before the hearing with Pilate on this Friday, they called another one before the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin was kind of like Israel's religious Supreme Court. It was made up basically of the chief priests and the Pharisees. And they have Jesus arrested, remember, it's very early on Friday. And they had this little secret trial before daybreak while it's still dark because it can kind of be secret, maybe illegal. They have to get this the crowd to hate Jesus, and they have to get Rome to crucify Jesus. They got a difficult task in front of them. Now, the quickest way to get Pilate to crucify Jesus was to tell him that he's a threat to Caesar. He's a threat to Rome. But if they tell the crowds that, the crowds are going to love him. So they have to come up with a couple of different charges. They charge Jesus with blasphemy, so the crowds will hate him for blaspheming the God of Israel. And they charge Jesus with treason, so Pilate will kill him because he's not a friend of Caesar. It's a very tough thing to do. And in fact, they couldn't get this done at trial. Mark records this real clearly. He says, the chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for evidence against Jesus so they could put him to death, but they did not find any. Many testified falsely against him, but their statements did not agree. And at this point, all Jesus has to do is not say anything. And at this point, Jesus once again does not remain silent. But he doesn't attempt to correct the false witnesses. He doesn't attempt to explain his mission correctly. He sits in silence while they mock him. But when they ask him, are you the Messiah? He makes this one statement. I am. Ego eimi. We saw this last week. The divine name of God. I am, said Jesus, and you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven. When he says this, he's pronouncing his death sentence. He's not saying you're going to see me floating down from the sky. He's using an Old Testament image to say, now you see God uniquely present and at work in me. And with that, Jesus hands them what they need for their verdict that they couldn't get from all of the false witnesses that they brought. Jesus does their work for him. So who's really making this happen? Is it Rome? The crowds? Pilate? Caesar? Herod? The chief priests or Pharisees? Who put Jesus on the cross? Well, there's this old story. It's often been used as a sermon illustration. It used to be. Some of you may have heard it before. Max Lucado talks about this in his book, God Came Near. And the story goes something like this. It's the story of an engineer who operated this massive drawbridge over this raging river. This river, and they would raise the drawbridge for boats to pass by, but lower it for trains to come through. Well, one day, this engineer takes his young son to work, and his son's very curious and asking all sorts of questions. And it's not until he raises the drawbridge for a boat to pass that he realizes his son has gone. He is out climbing on the massive gears to this drawbridge. And he's about to go out of the control cabin to rescue him when he realizes he hears a train in the distance. The train is heading toward this drawbridge. And he doesn't have time to get his son and still get back to lower the bridge. So it's either going to be this train of passengers that crashes and they all die or his son that dies. This is a horrible decision that he has to make. And the engineer knew what he had to do and he reaches for the lever to close the bridge. That's a very powerful story. Often used to describe the sacrifice of Christ, that God had to sacrifice Jesus to save a bunch of innocent people. And it's got some parallels. I mean, God could not save humanity without sacrificing his son. And we're a lot like the people on the train. Sometimes we're oblivious to the sacrifice that was made on our behalf. But there's a big problem with that story. Big, horrible, insurmountable problem. Listen to this. This is the first sermon ever preached about the cross. See if you can pick this out. Peter is speaking here. He says, "Fellow Israelites, listen to this. Jesus of Nazareth was the man accredited by God to you by miracles, wonders, and signs which God did among you through him, as you yourselves know. This man was handed over to you by God's deliberate plan and foreknowledge. And you, with the help of wicked men, put him to death by nailing him to the cross." See that? God's deliberate plan and foreknowledge. Jesus' death on the cross was no accident. Lucado writes this. He says, "Jesus' death was not the result of a panicking cosmological engineer. The cross wasn't a tragic surprise. Calvary was not a knee-jerk response to a world plummeting toward destruction. It wasn't a patch job or a stopgap measure. The death of the Son of God was anything but an unexpected peril. No, it was part of a plan. It means he didn't have to do it, but he did. The ropes used to tie his hands and the soldiers used to lead him to the cross were unnecessary. They were incidental. Had they not been there, had there been no trial, no pilot, no crowd, the very same crucifixion would have occurred. Had Jesus been forced to nail himself to the cross, he would have done it. For it was not the soldiers who killed him, not the screams of the mob. It was his devotion to us. On Friday, Jesus dies for the world, not because of anybody else. Wasn't Pilate, wasn't Herod, wasn't Caesar, wasn't the Pharisees, wasn't the crowds. Jesus says, I lay down my life for the sheep. Who's ever been like that man? Jesus says, no one takes my life from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. I have authority to lay it down and authority to take it up again. We've seen this over and over again. Last week, we saw when Jesus was arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane, that he revealed just a little hint of his true nature, and everybody was just bowled over. They were knocked off their feet because they saw a hint of his true glory. And Jesus could have just walked away, could have walked through all of those 200 or so people that came to arrest him. And just a few hours later, Jesus would hang on the cross, and the crowds would come by, and it says they would jeer at him. Mark says, those who passed by hurled insults at Jesus, shaking their heads and saying, so, you who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, come down from the cross and save yourself. In the same way, the chief priests and the teachers of the law mocked him among themselves. He saved others, they said, but he can't save himself. Let this Messiah, this King of Israel, come down now from the cross that we may see and believe. And I told you I would share with you what I think is the best reason for becoming a Christian. And it's right here. It's the fact that Jesus could have come down from the cross. He could have just walked down off that cross fully healed. He could have summoned a legion of angels. But he didn't. Because of me. Because of Rob Spar. Don't get me wrong. I believe if I was the only person to ever live outside of God's will, Jesus would have stayed on that cross because of me. Nobody's ever loved me like that before. And nobody ever will. Don't get me wrong. Jesus stayed on that cross because of you. If you had been the only person to ever live outside of God's will, Jesus would have stayed on the cross because of you. John 15:13 says, greater love has no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. On Friday, the one true Messiah in a world full of wannabes lays down his life. On Friday, God declares his heart for you and me and every sinful person who ever lived. On Friday, in a garden, a decision gets made and Jesus says, I will suffer, I will die, I will choose love. What's our response to that love? What's our response to the one who gave his everything to us? Well, we're called to give ourselves to him, everything we have. Do you love this man? Will you die to your own sin for him? Will you put him at the very center of your life? See, on Friday, when everything looks the darkest, we find that sin does not get the last word. Love does. And love triumphs over all. Would you pray with me? Take just a moment just to consider Jesus' love for you. The fact that he stayed on the cross for you. He suffered and he died for you. And if you're here this morning, you've never made a decision to put Jesus at the center of your life. Maybe you want to do that today. If you've already done that, I want to give you a moment now just to simply give worship and adoration and reverence to this Jesus. Just forget about whatever else is going on in your life right now. Things you got to do or things going on, good or bad. Set that aside and just allow your mind to be filled with wonder and love for this man who is the hinge of history and the hope of the world. Reflect for a moment on the reality. It's your sin, your guilt, your pardon for which Jesus died. And if it's been a while, would you just tell him now how much you love him?
Could I but love you, my comforter?